Our guest this morning is Edgar Villanueva, a nationally recognized expert on social justice philanthropy, and is the author of the book Decolonizing Wealth by Barrett Kohler Publishing. It offers alternatives to the dynamics of colonization in the philanthropic and social finance sectors. Edgar currently serves as chair of the board of directors of Native Americans in Philanthropy, a board member of the Andrus Family Fund, and vice president of programs and advocacy at the Schott Foundation for Public Education. In addition to working in philanthropy for many years, he has consulted with numerous nonprofit organizations, also some national and global philanthropies, on advancing racial equity issues inside of their institutions and through their investment strategies. Edgar Villanueva, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be on.
Well, tell me a little bit about the background. You worked in philanthropy for many years. What was your experience and purpose or idea in deciding to write Decolonizing Wealth?
After working in the field for a number of years, I began to see that there were a lot of challenges internal to philanthropy work that was making us, creating barriers for us to achieve our mission of equity. And so we often have stated missions of wanting to move the needle on different issues in communities, and especially communities of color and low-income communities. But because of the way that we often operate, we have had lots of challenges. So I wanted to offer some of my ideas on how we could move forward and be a better sector.
You're from the South, and in your book, you compare our history of philanthropy in this country to plantations and slaves. Elaborate on that for me.
Absolutely. So that metaphor is one that is quite literal and in some ways, because my first job working at a foundation in the South was actually located on a plantation on the estate of R.J. Reynolds. And so that that vision of that period of time in my life is very something that's kind of stuck with me through the years. But also that metaphor of going to work on a plantation is something that a lot of people of color who work in philanthropy have used sort of, you know, as a joke in some ways behind the scenes, describing how it felt for us as people of color coming into these organizations with extreme privilege and wealth, trying to do the work as sort of a tokenized person in the field.
Give me a little bit about the history of how philanthropy and funding started in this country, at least as a, I don't know, a corporate entity, if that's the right terminology.
Absolutely. So the sort of the sector of philanthropy, which is a part of the nonprofit sector, is one that a lot of people don't know because it has been relatively behind the scenes and ambiguous, I think, on purpose in some ways. But it really started in this country with the Rockefeller Foundation. As that corporation was growing and, of course, amassing tons of wealth, there was an incident with that industry that caused several lives to be lost and was a sort of a PR nightmare. And so there was this idea to sort of save face, to give money back out, to support and to do charity work as a way to help that company with this particular PR nightmare. And so with that type of incident became sort of the birth of American institutional philanthropy as we know it now, where corporations and wealthy families are able to set up organizations to fund charity work in this country. And these are often, you know, organizations or corporations that are maybe doing work that is harmful to communities or harmful to our land, but they often are doing this work in the name of charity that helps with their publicity and PR.
I know there's a tendency sometimes, and I'm only going to say the United Way, not to say anything negative against that, but as an example, a lot of times people are in a work environment and there's the annual campaign for them or any other organization, and so people donate a certain amount of money and then they just tune out for the rest of the year thinking, oh, that's a good organization. And I know that with some, like United Way, you can specify where your money goes if you're not happy with the general fund. Is that a big problem in this country, that people really aren't in touch with where their money is going?
I think it is a problem. We have had incidents of abuse with certain nonprofits that are raising money in this country. One, for example, I'm Native American, and there was an organization recently in the past couple of years that was raising millions of dollars to support Native young children using images of poor Native children on their marketing materials. However, none of that money was actually reaching young people. And so I highly encourage folks to do the work, to build a relationship, and to know the organizations that they're giving to.
Well, you know, in your book, you mention, of course, that very little philanthropy is actually going to people of color in this country. Could you elaborate a little more on what some of the things are that's preventing that from happening?
Absolutely. So when you look at the millions of dollars that are being invested in community from foundations, only about 7 to 8% of grants are actually reaching communities of color. And that number has been decreasing in the past couple of years. So I think that's a major injustice when you consider, one, our demographics in this country and where the need is so great. You see higher needs and disparities often in communities of color. And when you also think about the history of how wealth has been accumulated in this country and the contributions that people of color have made, it really is unfair. I think there's a number of things that contribute to the lack of investment in communities of color, starting with looking at who is working in foundations and what the board of directors of these organizations look like. There's a direct correlation between the staffing and governance of a foundation and where dollars are actually going. So we have a major diversity issue. By far, the board of directors and the CEO and leadership of foundations in this country happen to be white people. Therefore, they often don't have the networks and relationships and communities of color that would inform their giving decisions.
Do people who belong to these boards who are recruited to be on them, do you think their heart is in the right place, but they don't know the right thing to do, or do they not care? What's your feeling on that?
I would say, for the most part, the heart of people is in the right place. I've worked, for 15 years in this industry. Most of the people who work in philanthropy in the sector are very well-meaning. I think that there just is a lot of privilege that blinds people to different types of solutions and networks to support. And there's a lack of accountability. So even though we're well-meaning and well-doing, without any pressure or sort of speaking truth to that power that we hold, there hasn't just been the sort of political will to make changes, to do things differently.
We're speaking this morning with Edgar Villanueva, the author of the book Decolonizing Wealth. We will take your questions. That is at 800-838-3760, or you can email us a question at jx@jeffnet.org. We'll be back with more with Edgar Villanueva right after the short break. We're speaking this morning with Edgar Villanueva, author of the book Decolonizing Wealth. He offers a prescription for restoring balance and healing using indigenous wisdom. Edgar, a few questions. First of all, I wanted to know how you felt. Initially, it seemed like in reading your book, you were enthusiastic about going into foundational work as opposed to, say, some other type of corporate position with your education. Did you become disillusioned quickly by doing that, or was that something that developed over the years that you worked at the foundation?
It didn't take a long time for me to begin feeling disillusioned by working in philanthropy. Probably after a couple of years in, I began to understand that this was not a sector in many cases that was open to new ways of thinking. And so often people like me, who are people of color, who have gone to school, we have, great resumes, we get recruited in because of our experience and our relationship with the community. But coming into these organizations, we quickly find that we are expected to assimilate and sort of perpetuate the status quo. And so, it's really frustrating for a lot of people, especially people of color, who want to push the field forward, want to bring new ideas, want to do things differently, to find that that is not the culture of these types of institutions.
In your book, you offer a series of steps under the heading How to Heal, and you say it's important to begin by grieving. That was kind of unexpected as I read that in any discussion of money. Why do communities that are out seeking financial support need to grieve?
I think all of us need to do work in this country to come to terms with our relationship with money and wealth. Whether you are a person with wealth and maybe grappling with your family's history, perhaps guilt or whatever may be associated with that, or if you come from a community that has not had money, we often have different types of work that we need to do that's connected to how we feel about money and wealth and feeling worthy, perhaps. But the idea of grieving comes from a process. When we look back at our history of the accumulation of wealth in this country and how wealth has been historically accumulated through genocide, through our history of slavery, through our history of exploiting low-wage workers, this is a nasty truth about our country's history that we need to come to terms with. And when we really take time to examine that and how we have actually contributed to or perpetuated some of those dynamics, that have contributed to this gap between the haves and the have-nots, most of us are going to feel a process of grief when we come to terms with that truth.
Are there specific suggestions you have on how people can grieve? I know maybe that's an individual thing.
You know, I think I recently went through a grieving process just personally with some loss in my life, and I think there What I found in personally experiencing that and in talking to others who have experienced grief, it's something that sits in your body and you just have to be patient for it to work its way out. Mm-hmm. I think we have the tendency in this country to be very solutions-oriented and to want to move forward quickly and not focus on negative things, which I totally understand. But when you are really struck with grief, you know, there's really no way to deal with that but to allow it to work its way out. But I think to really allow the grief to pass, we have to reopen the wounds and get as honest and truthful about things as we possibly can in order to really get to a place of true healing on the other side of that grief.
On the phone with us now is Ryan in Eugene with a question or comment about holistics and money. Go ahead, Ryan.
Well, hi. I mean, fantastic discussion. I think that there's a lot of, you know, good-hearted people who are donating money to philanthropic organizations. But I think that the criticism is often that what they're doing is making themselves feel good and not necessarily really thinking about, you know, what I think is being called moving the needle. Really solving a problem. So rather than just giving somebody a meal, it's thinking about why that system is creating hungry people. And I think that the cultural change in that perspective is really important. And I'd like your comments, please.
Thank you, Ryan.
That's a really great question. I think that there is a movement within philanthropy to go beyond the charity transactional model. You know, that model is based, on often people feeling guilty and wanting to help, but not to actually have a relationship and dig in, you know, deeper into the roots of these problems. Because when you begin to peel back a lot of the reasons we have poverty in this country, it all goes back to having policies and systems in this country historically that have been rooted in white supremacy, that have perpetuated inequalities that we have. And so that is a history that is difficult for people to grapple with. So it's much easier to sort of give some money to alleviate the symptoms of poverty versus doing the hard work of coming to terms with and working to address the root issues of poverty.
A reminder, you can join our conversation by calling 800-838-3760 or email us a question at jx@jeffnet.org. We're also on Facebook and Twitter at Jeff Exchange. Edgar, tell us about the importance of apologizing and owning up to injustices that have happened in our country.
Something that's extremely important in any civilized society, when someone does something wrong, they apologize. right? This is something that we teach our children. If you do wrong, you need to apologize. And so in a healing process, in a process of truth and reconciliation, there needs to be an actual acknowledgement of the wrong that has happened, and that acknowledgement needs to be directed towards folks who have experienced, the downside of what has happened. And so you see this having happened in places like Canada, where there is a process of truth and reconciliation and an official apology from the government to First Nations people. I experienced this in my personal life recently in writing this book, and I tell the story in the book of a woman who did work in her family around their wealth and felt led to write a letter of apology to me and my ancestors. And there's something that's truly liberating about apologizing from a very sincere place, that's liberating not only for the person giving the apology, but for the person receiving the apology, that creates an openness for folks to come together and connect in ways that may have not been possible otherwise.
In your book, you stress the importance of listening, and that included a phrase that I thought was wonderful, listening in color. Explain what that means.
In my career of working as a funder and supporting many, many nonprofits, the number one thing that I hear back from nonprofit organizations about their relationship with funders is that they wish that funders would listen to them, which I really am appalled by that. And so I felt like that was really important to include in this book, because in order to begin to move away from grieving and apology to building a relationship that is authentic, we have to learn how to listen. And especially those of us who have privilege, who have resources, listening in color, I think, is sort of a term I coined that I think of as a superpower that helps you to really change the status quo, no matter what role you may play in an institution or whatever influence you may have. It requires really listening with an open heart, putting aside your own conclusions, opinions, and judgments, really to get to a place of taking in information and really seeing the world through someone else's life or experience.
In your book, you write that, I don't know if my terminology is good here, but that it's almost a mechanical sort of process when people come in and apply for funding, philanthropy. And depending upon what the particular foundation funds, they may or may not be successful. What do you think communities of color can do to better access philanthropy?
You know, I think that we have to come to terms with our own orientation and history as it relates to money in some ways. And I know for me, I had preconceived notions growing up about wealthy folks. And my mother was a domestic worker, which actually gave me some exposure to people in our community who had wealth because they often hired my mother. And so I learned pretty early on that my preconceived notions of people with money being maybe bad or evil or whatever, was actually a myth or a story that had been handed down to me, and that I needed to actually see folks for their humanity. Whether you have resources and you are, you know, or you don't have resources, we all actually have so much in common. We've all experienced pain. We've all experienced suffering. And so on both sides of that divide, if we can understand that in each other, it creates an openness for us to actually connect as human beings, putting aside sort of the transactional power dynamics of who has money and who doesn't have money.
You write lovingly in your book, expanding on what you just said, that your mother was the first philanthropist you knew. If it's not too personal, would you mind sharing a little bit more about the example she set and how she influenced you?
Sure, I'm happy to. I love talking about my mother. She, my mom had me when she was 15 years old. We were, I'm an enrolled member of the Lumbee Tribe, which is in southeastern North Carolina. And so we had a rough start to life. But beside, you know, regardless of that, my mom was very focused on supporting and giving back to the community. And a lot of this has to do with our Southern upbringing, but it also a lot of the indigenous native values and culture of reciprocity and being in community and taking care of others. So we were often through various aspects, a lot of them through the church that we belonged to when I was growing up. My mom was just always giving back and showing love and taking care of folks, even when we had very little. And I think that is something that's important for folks to know, that when we think of philanthropists, often, you know, the Rockefellers and the Fords of the world come to mind. But the data actually shows that poor people in this country give away a higher percentage of their incomes. Mm. And so we are actually the real philanthropists in this country.
In your book, you ask the question, try to quote it here exactly, what if funders no longer assume that disadvantaged communities and individuals need to be empowered? And as I read that, I thought that seems like a pretty dramatic shift in thinking, especially how people regard the so-called disadvantaged. What does that mean to make that shift in thinking about empowerment?
Well, there's a lot of conversation happening right now through this book and other things that have been written, really criticizing what some call the white savior complex. And this is, you know, because you have amassed a fortune and you have money, a lot of this money, you know, granted, is inherited money, so it's not necessarily money that is earned. You know, a lot of folks then feel entitled or privileged to go into communities with their ideas and their solutions without really engaging or asking what people in those communities need or want. I believe that those who are closest to the problems actually have the best ideas for how to solve those problems in our communities. I know that's the case in Native American communities. And so it's really, you know, getting at that dynamic of wanting to make sure that we are at the table and that we are leading and bringing the ideas for how to improve our communities in partnership with funders and people with wealth. Versus having to be subject to whatever ideas they may have that are imposed upon us.
We know that many of these boards are largely white and largely male. And are there any practical tips for improving the dialogue and getting folks like this out into the communities of color and really getting to know people and their exact needs?
Absolutely. I think that proximity is really important. You know, often if you are from wealth or you have assumed to a place of leadership that you are sitting on these boards, you just really may have no idea. And so, one, really be intentional about diversifying your staff and your board. And especially boards, even family foundations now, there's sort of a movement happening within philanthropy that's questioning that. And family foundations are opening their seats to folks with lived experience, folks from different types of communities, because we just know a diversity of perspective is going to really help inform and shape strategies and practices of organizations that are going to be a lot stronger at the end of the day.
For organizations that engage in philanthropy and hired paid employees, I don't know if in your time working in, if it was unusual for you to be on to be hired to engage in this. Are we seeing a trend where more people of color, more Native Americans in this country are being invited to be paid employees of some of these foundations?
There is a slight growth. When I started in the field, I was only one of 10 Native Americans in the country who worked in philanthropy. Now, 15 years later, we are up to about 25 people. So there is some slow growth. The thing that is alarming is that the number of people of color is actually decreasing. There's a sort of an annual census that comes out from an organization called Council on Foundations that collects this data. And so I think, this is a result of there being lots of focus on diversity initiatives in the nonprofit sector over the past years and really good intentions to bring people into these organizations. However, if we're not willing to examine the culture of foundations to change things so that we have cultures that where folks feel like they belong and that they can thrive and succeed, people are not going to stay. And I think that's what we're seeing now.
Are the mechanisms in place to examine these communities better?
I think there are more mechanisms in place. Philanthropy is a sector that likes to self-correct, so to speak. We have a number of sort of think tanks and organizations that do research on the sector. A lot of attention over the past couple years has been focused on the internal culture of foundations, which really excites me because most of our work is focused externally or focused on how we're giving or who we're giving to. But the dynamics within organizations, sort of the internal workings of, you know, equity and belonging and kind of practicing what we preach, so to speak, is really important. And so there are a number of initiatives that are now looking at those dynamics.
And are these organizations pretty receptive to having maybe individuals like yourself or others come in and try to train them in ways to improve their outlook and how they diversify themselves?
I think so. This book has been wildly successful within the philanthropic sector. I'm keynoting pretty much every conference between now and June. We sold 5,000 copies of the book in the first month because I do think there is an appetite from the philanthropic sector and definitely from the broader nonprofit sector to get to the root of what some of the challenges are around diversity, equity, and inclusion. We've been talking about DEI now for a number of years. It's been a topic and theme of various conferences. But now there is an opportunity to really go deep and try to think about how do we actually deliver on these conversations and operationalize some of these ideas.
A reminder, you can join our conversation by calling 800-838-3760 or emailing us at jx@jeffnet.org. We're also on Facebook and Twitter at Jeff Exchange. Our guest this morning is Edgar Villanueva, nationally recognized expert on social justice philanthropy and author of the book Decolonizing Wealth. We take a look at the alternatives to the dynamics of colonization in both the philanthropic and social finance sectors. We'll take a short break here, and we'll be back with more questions for you from to call in or just a conversation we're having this morning with Edgar. We are speaking this morning with Edgar Villanueva. He's an expert on social justice philanthropy and author of Decolonizing Wealth. We're taking your questions here at the Jefferson Exchange, 800-838-3760. Edgar, I wanted to ask you, do you see, you know, we think of colonialism as something that was maybe back ending in the 19th century. It's really, you know, to some extent in the 20th century, but it's not really a term that gets used a lot anymore. In your opinion, do you think that maybe this is a broader question than just philanthropy, but do you think colonialism or colonial thinking, especially in America, is still a problem today?
I do. I'm beginning to hear this term used to frame what's happening in our current political environment in many ways. In the book, I talk about colonization as a virus that touched the shores of our country 500 years ago, and the dynamics of colonization, which are very much connected to the accumulation of wealth. You know, slavery, genocide, the forced assimilation, all of that was all of that happened so that that folks could get more money and out of a place of greed and domination and fear. And so those types of symptoms of this virus are still very pervasive in our public policies and in our systems. They show up, you know, we see sometimes quite literally things happening where children are being taken from their homes and put in cages, such as what's happening at the border. But more often what we see and are unaware of are how these dynamics are showing up in our institutions and culture in very subtle ways because we've become quite accustomed and used to thinking in this dominant way.
Outside of the work that you originally did, eventually you moved on, and I believe you're still a member of Board of Directors of Native Americans in Philanthropy. Is that right?
That's correct.
And as you moved away from the traditional corporate sector from your first job. You talk a lot in your book about the importance of looking back to Native American wisdom as a way to sort of heal this process and to move the needle, as I believe the caller said earlier. How do you see that operating, and what kind of wisdom and advice have you gotten? As you mentioned, you're Native American, but from other Native American folks that you've encountered?
Absolutely. So in my own personal experience being Native, which being Native in this country involves an inherent identity crisis for a lot of different reasons. In and out of philanthropy and different jobs, I'm now working at my third foundation. I took some time in writing this book to sort of steal away and spend time in my community talking with elders. And it was very much a healing process for me to be regrounded in my culture and my traditions and learnings, and to sort of remember what we believe and what's been handed down to me. At the end of that time and all of these conversations, I sort of had an aha moment that this knowledge and this wisdom is something that everyone needs, and it could absolutely be applied to the sector of philanthropy and social impact investing, because we are in the business of building community and taking care of one another and supporting people, right? Where philanthropy literally means the love of humankind. And so all of that wisdom about how we exist and support one another and love one another in community, I think absolutely is able to be translated to what we can do in this sector to be more connected to the heart of our missions.
In the book, you write about reparations as part of the healing process. I know that this is sort of a hot-button topic for many people. What are some ways that you see that could work?
So I bring up reparations because it is interesting to me how it's a hot button topic. In writing this book, I began to think about what could we do to actually, in philanthropy, with the $800 billion of assets that we're sitting on, what could we really do to begin to use that money as medicine to actually help heal or repair or undo the harm that the accumulation of wealth has caused in our history? And so reparations is one of those ideas that's been brought up many times. There's a gentleman whose name escapes me at the moment who has brought legislation to Congress every session for many years. And it's a non-starter for many folks, because I think we have not in this country created the appetite to have even a consideration for what we might do to sort of repair or payback, you know, for the harm that's been caused, because we haven't done that work of actually acknowledging our history. And so I put reparations out there as a conversation starter, because I do believe that there are things that philanthropy could do that are, some may consider to be a bit more radical, but we have a lot of money and a lot of resources. So I think that we could actually lead the way doing some things that are different, to begin to close this wealth divide between the haves and the have-nots.
You mentioned Congress, of course, outside of perhaps your level of expertise as a philanthropist working in an organization for philanthropy. Has Congress traditionally been an ally at all, or have they been, you know, just a stumbling block?
You know, it's interesting. So I think that the government's relationship with philanthropy has been one of, you know, a friend. Some would say that philanthropy is plugging a hole that the government should be, taking care of in terms of providing safety net services, because we don't have philanthropy in any other country the way that it exists in the U.S. Because in this country we have a tax system where the wealthy cannot pay taxes, they can start a foundation, and then, with those resources, kind of have the authority to direct them as they so choose. We are losing lots of public revenue, right, through this lack of taxation. And so there's kind of this give and take that I think people see. We have been, as a sector, pretty much protected from legislation. I don't know if that's going to be the case in the future. I think as times get more difficult and state budgets and federal budgets become more strapped and we see poverty and inequality growing in this country, it's possible, quite possible, that the government itself could look toward the coffers of foundations and think of ways to, get those resources. Because for the most part, you know, those resources are not actually invested in the community. The majority, 95% of those resources, are actually currently invested in Wall Street. And so I think there's a lot of possibility for things to change in the future.
I'm going to guess that those investments in Wall Street are not exactly in social justice stocks, are they?
No, you're right. And this is a little known fact by the public about foundations. And so, again, there's $800 billion that has been sheltered from taxation that, you know, in the coffers of private foundations. When you the only requirement by the federal government is that 5%, only 5% of those resources are granted into the community. And so then 95% of the resources are invested in Wall Street. And you're right, the data shows that the majority of those investments, about 85% of those investments, are actually in harmful and extractive industries, such as private prisons and, oil, gun manufacturing. And so we have to, ask ourselves, what is the net value of philanthropy when we begin to look at where money is actually being invested?
Well, you kind of touched on this about the concentration of wealth in this country. And again, this is broader than philanthropy, but there's been so much talk about the disappearance of the middle class. But of course, we haven't heard a whole lot about people who are marginalized and live in those particular communities. Is that flowing down through philanthropy as well, that communities of color and others kind of on the edges in terms of financial survival, they're also being impacted negatively about that concentration of wealth?
Absolutely. I think that we in philanthropy are, perpetuating that dynamic and contributing to that growing divide between the haves and the have-nots. And that shows up, in, the ways where money is going. As we mentioned, the amount of money being invested in communities of color is actually decreasing. It's only a measly 7 to 8%. In Native communities, it's less than a third of 1%. And so when we are not using this money to close the race wealth gap in every way possible, then we are actually perpetuating it, because we are the grant making that is happening is predominantly going to large white institutions, universities that may not actually have the most need for the resources.
We're speaking this morning with Edgar Villanueva about the dynamics of colonization in the philanthropic and giving sectors, and he is the author of the book Decolonizing Wealth. If you have a question for Edgar, you can give us a call at 800-838-3760 or email us a question, jx@jeffnet.org. I wanted to toss out a scenario. Let's say that it's a very small nonprofit that has been formed in a community by someone or a small group of people who feel very passionately about an issue, and they are just struggling to survive, especially in this climate where there's not as much philanthropy necessarily for organizations that aren't household names. How do they look at things philosophically and say, okay, I'm not going to take money from XYZ because of how they have treated people of color in the past or any other issues? And yet they're trying to, just as a small nonprofit, trying to survive and get a little money in the front door. What would you say to a group like that?
Yeah, that's really tough. It's complicated because we have created this system where nonprofits are so dependent on this, this dance between foundations and nonprofits that is not serving a lot of people well. I think what I would say is, one, every nonprofit, regardless of its size, should be super clear and of its mission and grounded in its values, and be unwilling to compromise and change that because of a funder that may come in and say, you need to do this, that, or the third. So be really clear and understand that your accountability as a nonprofit is to the community and to the people that you serve first. And then secondly, I would say that there are a number of funders and that are great partners. And so try to seek out a partner that really does align with your mission and what you're trying to do, and see if they are a good listener, right? If they come to visit or you get a meeting with them and they're actually listening more so than sort of directing you, then I think that's, you know, one indicator of someone who is going to end up being a good partner. And so those funders are out there, even in institutions, funding institutions that may not have the best reputation. It's likely that there's at least some staff within that organization that are going to be advocates to support the work and to try to move these resources.
You know, in recent years, of course, we have changed our language about how we refer to people and tried to make it less judgmental, more inclusive. Is that a problem in the philanthropic sector as well?
It is a problem. I think that we perpetuate, you know, negative narratives often about people living in poverty and communities of color by the language that we use as foundations. In fact, the foundation where I started my career in North Carolina, we had a division there that was called the Poor and Needy Division. And, you know, this was like antiquated language that had been written into the will of Mrs. Reynolds, but it was only in the last 5 years that that language finally changed. And so, you know, just sort of the mindset and the narrative there around having people to apply to this, to the Poor and Needy Division, because they were helping poor and needy people. And so language really matters. We can use language that acknowledges the assets in communities and the resilience of communities, or we can use language that kind of labels them as takers and, you know, folks who are not contributors to our communities.
We have about a minute left, but I wanted to kind of wrap up by asking you broadly, what discussions about healing, because that seems an important word with your book, what discussions about healing do you hope this book generates?
I think that we are in a place where we need a lot of healing. This country is extremely polarized at the moment. We are seeing hate on display in ways that I never imagined in my lifetime. And so I think that we can, in ourselves, explore what pain that we're holding and find ways to begin to release that and do our own healing. Hurting people hurt others, and healing people heal others. And so I have been doing the work of healing in my life, and I hope that I'm able to help others heal, even people who are not like me or have the same political outlook. We have got to find ways to acknowledge, again, that common humanity in each other to try to bring this country back together.
We've been speaking this morning with Edgar Villanueva, author of Decolonizing Wealth. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me on.